Apart from the fact that Dr. Sam said it was a good book, I bought it because I wondered whether there might be any crossover from human healthcare into animal healthcare. While I was reading, there was always a little part of my brain wondering just how much could be transferred to the animal healthcare sector. I'm sure that plenty could, just in a different way. Some musings I had, for example, were, could veterinarians, for example, positively impact the healthcare outcome of sentient animals through compassion? What difference would the expression of compassion to the patient's owner make to the health outcome of your patient? If the client felt more compassion towards them, would they be less aggressive towards you, the veterinary professional? Would animal doctors hear fewer emotional blackmail and accusations about not caring, otherwise you'd work for free? All of these thoughts were going through my head while I was reading. If you've read the book, I'd be especially keen to hear what your thoughts were from a veterinarian point of view. According to Martin Luther King, life's most urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Compassion, community, health and longevity. That's the theme for episode 17 of Paws, Claws and Wet Noses, the podcast celebrating all creatures, great and small, and the fantabulous professionals who look after them all. I'm your show host, Julie South. At the beginning of this year, I had the opportunity of catching up with a vet staff locum for lunch. We solved all the problems currently facing the veterinary sector and the world. Over lunch, Dr. Sam shared a book she'd read called Compassionomics, a book designed to answer a few questions, one of which was, does taking time for compassion make doctors better at their job? I'm a Kindle woman, so I bought the Kindle version. It's also available in paperback and Audible versions as well. I'll include all links to where you can buy the book if you're interested on the show notes page for episode 17 of Paws, Claws, Wet Noses.fm. The full official title is Compassionomics, the revolutionary scientific evidence that caring makes a difference. I like meaty books, and at 375 pages, this sure gave me something to get my teeth into. The book was published in 2018 by Firestarter Publishing. Hi, this is Julie South, and you're listening to Paws, Claws, and Wet Noses, the Kiwi Veterinary Sector Podcast. If you're a Kiwi veterinary professional, then stay tuned because this show is for you. Each week's podcast is purpose-built to help you grow your veterinary business, yourself, or your life. You can find all the show notes and links mentioned in today's show at pawsclawswetnoses.fm. Compassionomics was written by two human medical doctors, Drs. Stephen Chesiak and Dr. Anthony Mazzarelli. Dr. Chesiak, MD, MPH, is a physician scientist, professor, and chair of medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, and the chief of medicine at Cooper University Healthcare in Camden, New Jersey. Dr. Chesiak is a practicing intensivist, meaning he specializes in intensive care medicine. And as you'll hear him say later, you only get to meet him when it's come down to life and death for you. He's a National Institutes of Health-funded clinical researcher with more than 100 publications in scientific literature, primarily in the field of resuscitation science. He's no lightweight when it comes to research and writing. Dr. Chesiak's publications have been featured in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Circulation, and the New England Journal of Medicine. His scientific program has been supported by research grants from the National Institute of General Medicine Sciences. His scientific program has been supported by research grants from the National Institute of General Medical Sciences and the National Heart, Lung and Blood Institute, with Dr. Chesiak serving in the role of principal investigator. Dr. Anthony Mazzarelli, or Dr. Mazza, MD, JD, MBE, is a practicing emergency medicine physician who's co-president of Cooper University Healthcare and the Associate Dean of Clinical Affairs for Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. Prior to his current role, Dr. Mazzarelli served as Cooper's Chief Physician Executive, where he oversaw the physician practice as well as quality patient safety and continuous process improvement efforts for the health system, the same topics he teaches within the medical school and residency programs. Dr. Mazzarelli has been named one of the 50 most powerful people in New Jersey healthcare and was awarded the Halo Award for leading a team of healthcare providers from Cooper into Haiti in the days immediately following the 2010 earthquake. Dr. Mazzarelli's also received numerous commendations for his leadership. In other words, both these guys know their stuff. Compassionomics is aimed at the non-specialist, non-academic reader like me, primarily interested in human healthcare delivery. Apart from the fact that Dr. Sam said it was a good book, I bought it because I wondered whether there might be any crossover from human healthcare into animal healthcare. While I was reading, there was always a little part of my brain wondering just how much could be transferred to the animal healthcare sector. I'm sure that plenty could, just in a different way. Some musings I had, for example, were, could veterinarians, for example, positively impact the healthcare outcome of sentient animals through compassion? What difference would the expression of compassion to the patient's owner make to the health outcome of your patient? If the client felt more compassion towards them, would they be less aggressive towards you, the veterinary professional? Would animal doctors hear fewer emotional blackmail and accusations about not caring, otherwise you'd work for free? All of these thoughts were going through my head while I was reading. If you've read the book, I'd be especially keen to hear what your thoughts were from a veterinarian point of view. Please leave your thoughts in the comments section wherever you're listening to this podcast, or send me an email to julie@vetstaff.co.nz. Thanks. But less of my musings and back to the book. Dr. Chesiak insists his conversion to compassionomics transformed his life, given he wasn't that particularly enthralled with the idea of writing it to start with. He was a self-proclaimed, not touchy-feely man. Give him science and hard facts and he's in his element, but touchy-feely soft stuff, not so much his thing. The book came into being because Dr. Chesiak's new boss, Dr. Mazzarelli, came to him with a mission. He wanted Chesiak to prove or disprove that treating patients with medicine and compassion makes a measurable difference to the well-being of both patients and doctors. Chesiak expected the answer to be no. Compassion made no difference whatsoever. He got that compassion was a good thing to have, but he expected to report back that caring had no quantitative rationale. However, after trawling through over 1,000 scientific extracts and 250 research papers and having his former beliefs disproved, he's now a true and passionate convert, taking his message to a wider medical audience. His message, it seems, is one that people are ready and wanting to hear. The pair concluded that compassion does have the power to transform medicine. When healthcare providers take time to make human connections that help end suffering, patient outcomes improve, and medical costs decrease. Among other benefits, compassion reduces pain, improves healing, lowers blood pressure, and helps alleviate depression and anxiety. Compassion and the role it plays in medicine isn't new. However, Compassionomics takes a novel approach. This book looks at compassion from a scientific perspective rather than a moral or an ethical one. Using already obtained scientific evidence, the authors were able to prove the importance of compassion as measurable. The data show that healthcare outcomes are dependent not only on how much healthcare providers know, but on how much they care. Compassionate, patient-centered care leads to happier, healthier patients and lower healthcare costs. The bit that interested me was that there's evidence that compassion may protect healthcare providers from burnout. I wondered how that might cross-pollinate into animal healthcare providers, people like you, veterinary doctors, nurses, surgeons, and technicians. I don't know the answer to that, but if you're like Dr. Sam, who believes in the power of compassion as a veterinarian, I'd love for you to be able to share your experiences so other veterinarians can benefit. As Dr. Cheziak says, once you realize how powerful you are just through the act of caring, you'll want to get better at compassion every day. When you think about it, it doesn't take any more time to be compassionate than it does to be dispassionate. Time is money in business, and all businesses are doing their best to get their teams to be more efficient. The pressures in the healthcare system to provide better care while minimizing rising costs against spending cuts just adds more pressure to otherwise stressful jobs. Most healthcare workers believe they just simply don't have the time to treat patients with compassion. Researchers from Johns Hopkins University performed a randomized controlled trial on cancer patients as they interacted with an oncologist. The researchers found that the patients who received enhanced compassion intervention had significantly less anxiety at the end of the consultation. With a selected use of words and meaning, the impact of this consultation was timed to be just 40 seconds. So when you think about it, we all really can find the time. As I said earlier, compassion doesn't just benefit the recipient. It seems to benefit the giver as well. Researchers at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania found that when people spent time doing good for others, in this case, by writing an encouraging note to a gravely ill child, it actually changed their perception of time to make them feel like they had more of it. I wonder if veterinarians are like human doctors. Apparently, 56% of human doctors say they don't have the time to be empathetic. According to Cheziak, the evidence shows that when you invest time in other people, you actually feel that you have more time or that you're not in so much of a hurry. He says that when 56% say they don't have the time in that survey, it's probably all in their heads. The same survey found that for the doctors who said they were too busy to be empathetic, after a short training session in the neuroscience of empathy, those doctors then started to interact with patients in ways the patients rated as more empathetic. Because compassion also seems to prevent doctor burnout, can it prevent veterinarian burnout as well? Med students are often warned about getting too close to their patients because too much exposure to human suffering is likely to lead to exhaustion. But the opposite appears to be true. Evidence shows that connecting with patients makes physicians happier and more fulfilled. As Cheziak said, we've always heard that burnout crushes compassion. It's probably more likely that those people with low compassion, those are the ones that are predisposed to burnout. He went on to say that human connection, and specifically a compassionate connection, can actually build resilience and resistance to burnout. Cherziak and Mazzarelli hope their evidence-based arguments will spur medical schools to make compassion part of the curriculum. Imagine if veterinary schools included compassion as part of their training for doctors, nurses, and technicians too. For those outside the human healthcare system, acting with compassion can be a kind of therapy as well, both authors say. They refer to the phenomenon of the helper's high, the good feeling that comes from helping others, and explain how giving to others benefits the giver's brains and nervous systems. Dr. Cherziak had his own epiphany while writing the book. He didn't realize at the time he was actually going through his own form of burnout. One of the things that triggered this realization was when his son asked for help with his homework. His son wanted help with the question, "What is the most pressing problem of our time?" He believed his work to that point was meaningful, but it was definitely not the most pressing problem of our time. Along the way, he says, he realized he was feeling burned out after 20 years of practicing medicine. So, armed with the data from his book research, he decided to test his own hypotheses. He was the N of one. The usual recommended prescription is what he calls escapism, where we're told to get away, detach, pull back, go on some nature hikes or whatever. Get out into the great outdoors and escape. He decided instead, though, to apply the techniques he'd been studying, including spending at least 40 seconds expressing compassion to patients. He said he connected more, not less. He cared more, not less. He leaned in rather than pulled back. It was only by doing those things, not heading off into the bush, that he noticed the fog of burnout lifting. He prescribes the same for anyone, not just healthcare workers, suffering from mental or emotional exhaustion. Here's an extract of a TEDx talk in Pennsylvania from 2018 by Dr. Stephen Cherziak entitled, "How 40 Seconds of Compassion Could Save a Life."
But what about time? We've all heard the expression, time is money, but time is also a vital factor in the efficiency and the economics of healthcare. So here's a staggering number, 56. Research from Harvard University shows that 56% of physicians believe they do not have time for compassion. This is in the context of a classic study from Princeton University on helping behaviors, which found that it wasn't the intrinsic belief of the importance of helping by the potential helper. It was whether or not the potential helper believed they had enough time to help. So how long does it actually take for a meaningful expression of compassion? To address this, researchers from Johns Hopkins University did a randomized controlled trial in patients with cancer who were having a consultation with the oncologist. And in this randomized trial, the primary outcome measure was anxiety. And if you have cancer, that's a pretty important outcome measure. So they found that patients randomized to a compassion intervention from the oncologist had less anxiety than usual care. So what was the compassion intervention? I could describe it for you, but instead I'm just going to read it to you. From the oncologist. At the beginning of the consultation, "I know this is a tough experience to go through, and I want you to know that I am here with you. Some of the things that I say to you today may be difficult to understand, so I want you to feel comfortable in stopping me if something I say is confusing or doesn't make sense. We are here together, and we will go through this together." And at the end of the consultation, the oncologist said, "I know this is a tough time for you, and I want to emphasize again that we are in this together. I will be with you each step along the way. So how long did that take? They timed it 40 seconds. So this randomized trial shows that all you need is 40 seconds of compassion to make a meaningful difference. Importantly, 40 seconds of compassion can be a powerful therapy for the giver too. And this is important because these data are not just applicable to healthcare workers, but to everyone here today. Science shows that compassion for others can have a direct positive effect on your own well-being. Neuroscience studies show that compassion for others can trigger reward pathways in the brain and positive emotion that can buffer or even counteract the activation of stress pathways and negative emotion. So, in effect, compassion for others can make you forget your own worries, at least temporarily. So now this is where the science meets the personal. A couple of years ago, after nearly 20 years of working in the ICU and meeting people on the worst day of their life, I came to a stark realization. I had almost every symptom of burnout. And let me assure you, that's not a good place to be. It can be a dark place. Currently, the recommended prescription for burnout is what I call escapism. Get away. Detach. Pull back. Go on some nature hikes or whatever. But I was not buying it because I believed that the antidote to burnout had to be at the point of care. In personal connection, human connection, not an escape. So what was I supposed to do? Well, I did the only thing I knew how to do. I took the research nerd approach. And armed with the data that 40 seconds of compassion can be a powerful therapy for the giver too, I decided to do an experiment on myself. I was the only research subject in this experiment. I was the N of one. So I tested the hypothesis that my 40 seconds of compassion would transform my experience. I connected more, not less. Cared more, not less. Leaned in rather than pulling back. And that was when the fog of burnout began to lift. My 40 seconds of compassion changed everything for me. Now, you might be thinking, I'm speaking on the power of compassion. I must be the most compassionate doctor. But the truth, if I'm being honest, is that I'm still a work in progress. I'm working hard at compassion every day, but I see it now. And thankfully, science shows that change can happen. I used to think that people were either wired for compassion or they were not. But the preponderance of evidence in the scientific literature, both in healthcare workers and in the general population, shows quite clearly that compassionate behaviors can, in fact, be learned. And that is good news indeed. So now it's time to answer the big question that I posed to you at the beginning. Does compassion matter? My systematic review of the literature now complete, 1,000 scientific abstracts, 200 research manuscripts, and one life-changing N of one experiment behind me. I now conclude with confidence, compassion matters for patients, for patient care, and for those who care for patients. Compassionate care belongs in the domain of evidence-based medicine. I no longer believe in this paradigm behind me, this historical paradigm. I now believe in this one. Because I found that there is science in the art of medicine. And the science is strong. I like to call this field compassionomics. It's the convergence of the science and the art of medicine. I will close just by acknowledging that you don't have to be a healthcare worker to feel burned out. And if you do, I suggest that you test the compassion hypothesis for yourself. Do your N of one experiment. Look and see those around you in need of compassion and give them your 40 seconds of compassion. See how it transforms your experience. But don't do it because I say so. Do it because science says so. 40 seconds of compassion can change everything for a patient. It changed everything for me. It can change everything for you too. And that is the power of 40 seconds.
Paws, Claws, and Wet Noses is sponsored by VetStaff. If you've never heard of VetStaff, it's New Zealand's only full-service recruitment agency, 100% dedicated to the veterinary sector. VetStaff has been around since 2015 and works nationwide, from Cape Reinga to the Bluff and everywhere in between. As well as helping Kiwis, VetStaff also helps overseas qualified veterinarians find work in Aotearoa, New Zealand. VetStaff.co.nz. Compassionomics is written in three sections. The first is the case for compassion, which refers to a bus crash in Sweden.
On February 27, 2007, on a snowy stretch of highway outside of Uppsala, Sweden, two buses collided head-on. Six people died, but miraculously, 56 people were saved. 5 years later, researchers asked the question, what do survivors remember? They interviewed every survivor, and using a rigorous qualitative research methodology, they found two common themes in the data. The first was expected, the physical pain that they felt at the moment of impact. But the other theme, a lack of compassion from the caregivers at all the hospitals. That's what they remembered 5 years later. These data have begun to open my eyes to a stark reality. In healthcare, we are in the midst of a compassion crisis.
From here, the authors share a pretty strong argument that compassion matters. They reference research from a University of Chicago study that found primary care physicians missed 79% of emotional cues from patients that indicated a need for a compassionate response. They also describe a Johns Hopkins ICU study that found 74% of healthcare providers showed no evidence of compassion for patients or families. The second section, Compassion Improves Outcome for Patients, examines research showing that medical outcomes, parasympathetic responses, psychological well-being of patients, self-care by patients, and even patients' sense of purpose are all affected by physician compassion. One study cited a 370-patient primary care setting study. The researchers found the strength of the doctor-patient relationship was associated with a 34% increased likelihood of the patient adhering to prescribed medications. In one aged care study, researchers found that when the residents felt their caregivers actually cared about them as individuals, the residents were less likely to be depressed. The third section of the book, Beyond Patient, examines how compassionate care increases hospital revenue, cuts costs, and how even physicians who are not naturally warm and intuitive can learn to demonstrate compassion. One of the studies cited was the one Dr. Chesiak referenced TEDx talk clip earlier, where the 40 seconds made a difference to patient care. In case you didn't pick up the phrase used in the study, it was, I know this has been a tough experience to go through, and I want you to know that I'm here with you. We're here together, and we'll go through this together. I'll be with you each step along the way. I'll put those words in on the show notes page at pauseclausewetnoses.fm for you. If you're into books with lots of research, then you might enjoy this one because there's lots of research backing it up. The research and data is heavy and solid. I also mistakenly thought that because there was a derivative of the word economics in the book's title, that it would have more case studies from a business growth and improvement perspective. There wasn't, and because of that, I was a little bit disappointed. One of my own conclusions is that, apart from the lack of compassion we seem to be heading towards today, is also the lack of community. I think the two are interrelated, and with that in mind, I'd near like to introduce you to the Rosita effect. If lockdown did one thing for me last year, and for a lot of other people it seems, is that it got us to slow down. For some, we almost went back to life similar to that of the 1950s. Families started having meals together again. Bread, baked at home, was shared again around the family meal table. Meals were made from scratch and eaten slowly. All of that reminded me of the benefits of living like Rosetans. The Rosita effect is the phenomenon by which a close-knit community experienced a reduced rate of heart disease. The effect is named for Rosita, a tiny Italian origin town in Pennsylvania with a population of about 1,600 people. The Rosita effect was first noticed in 1961 when the local Rosita doctor and the then head of medicine of the University of Oklahoma got to chatting over a couple of beers about the unusually low rate of myocardial infarction in Rosita compared with the rest of the United States at the time. Rosita bucked the then US trend. They smoked like trains, drank like fish, ate a high-fat diet, and worked in very lung-unhealthy environments. But why weren't they suffering heart attacks like everyone else in America at the time? In addition, the crime rate in Rosita was almost non-existent, and almost no one received welfare. Why was that? Researchers came to the conclusion it was because they had community. Here's an excerpt from another book, this one by Malcolm Gladwell, in his book Outliers, The Story of Success, where he describes the Rosita effect.
Rosetto Valfattore lies 100 miles southeast of Rome, in the Apennine foothills of the Italian province of Foggia. In the style of medieval villages, the town is organized around a large central square. Facing the square is the Palazzo Marchesale, the palace of the Seghese family, once the great landowner of these parts. An archway to one side leads to a church, the Madonna del Carmine. Narrow stone steps run up the hillside, flanked by closely clustered two-story stone houses with red tile roofs. For centuries, the paesani of Rosetto worked in the marble quarries in the surrounding hills, or cultivated the fields in the terraced valley below, walking 4 and 5 miles down the mountain in the morning and then making the long journey back up the hill at night. It was a hard life. The townsfolk were barely literate and desperately poor and without much hope for economic betterment until word reached Rosetta at the end of the 19th century of the land of opportunity across the ocean. In January of 1882, a group of 11 Rosettans, 10 men and one boy, set sail for New York. They spent their first night in America sleeping on the floor of a tavern on Mulberry Street in Manhattan's Little Italy. Then they ventured west, eventually finding jobs in a slate quarry 90 miles west of the city near the town of Bangor, Pennsylvania. The following year, 15 Rosettans left Italy for America, and several members of that group ended up in Bangor as well, joining their compatriots in a slate quarry. Those immigrants, in turn, sent word back to Rosetto about the promise of the New World, and soon one group of Rosettans after another packed their bags and headed for Pennsylvania, until the initial stream of immigrants became a flood. In 1894 alone, some 1,200 Rosettans applied for passports to America, leaving entire streets of their old village abandoned. The Rosettans began buying land on a rocky hillside, connected to Bangor by a steep, rutted wagon path. They built closely clustered two-story stone houses with slate roofs on narrow streets running up and down the hillside. They built a church and called it Our Lady of Mount Carmel, and named the main street on which it stood Garibaldi Avenue, after the great hero of Italian unification. In the beginning, they called their town New Italy, but they soon changed it to Rosetto, which seemed only appropriate given that in the previous decade, almost all of them had come from the same village in Italy. In 1896, a dynamic young priest by the name of Father Pasquale Danisco took over at Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Danisco set up spiritual societies and organized festivals. He encouraged the town folk to clear the land and plant onions, beans, potatoes, melons, and fruit trees in the long backyards behind their houses. He gave out seeds and bulbs. The town came to life. The Rosettans began raising pigs in their backyards and growing grapes for homemade wine. Schools, a park, a convent, and a cemetery were built. Small shops and bakeries and restaurants and bars opened along Garibaldi Avenue. More than a dozen factories sprang up, making blouses for the garment trade. Neighboring Bangor was largely Welsh and English, and the next town over was overwhelmingly German, which meant, given the fractious relationships between the English and Germans and Italians in those years, that Rosetto stayed strictly for Rosettans. If you had wandered up and down the streets of Rosetto in Pennsylvania in the first few decades after 1900, you would have heard only Italian spoken. And not just any Italian, but the precise southern Foggian dialect spoken back in the Italian Rosetto. Rosetto, Pennsylvania was its own tiny self-sufficient world, all but unknown by the society around it, and may well have remained so, but for a man named Stuart Wolfe. Wolfe was a physician. He studied digestion in the stomach and taught in a medical school at the University of Oklahoma. He spent his summers on a farm in Pennsylvania, not far from Rosetto, although that, of course, didn't mean much, since Rosetto was so much in its own world, it was possible to live one town over and never know much about it. One of the times when we were up there for the summer, this would have been in the late 1950s, I was invited to give a talk at the local medical society, Wolfe said years later in an interview. After the talk was over, one of the local doctors invited me to have a beer. And while we were having a drink, he said, "You know, I've been practicing for 17 years. I get patients from all over, and I rarely find anyone from Rosetto under the age of 65 with heart disease." Wolfe was taken aback. This was the 1950s, years before the advent of cholesterol-lowering drugs and aggressive prevention of heart disease. Heart attacks were an epidemic in the United States. They were the leading cause of death in men under the age of 65. It was impossible to be a doctor, common sense said, and not see heart disease. Wolfe decided to investigate. He enlisted the support of some of his students and colleagues from Oklahoma. They gathered together the death certificates from residents of the town, going back as many years as they could. They analyzed physicians' records. They took medical histories and constructed family genealogies. "We got busy," Wolfe said. "We decided to do a preliminary study. We started in 1961. The mayor said, 'All my sisters are going to help you.' He had four sisters. He said, 'You can have the town council room.' I said, 'Where are you going to have council meetings?' He said, 'Well, we'll postpone them for a while. The ladies would bring us lunch. We had little booths where we would take blood, do EKGs. We were there for 4 weeks. Then I talked with the authorities. They gave us the school for the summer. We invited the entire population of Rosetto to be tested." The results were astonishing. In Rosetto, virtually no one under 55 had died of a heart attack or showed any signs of heart disease. For men over 65, the death rate from heart disease in Rosetto was roughly half that of the United States as a whole. The death rate from all causes in Rosetto, in fact, was 30 or 35% lower than it should have been. Wolfe brought in a friend of his, a sociologist from Oklahoma named John Brune, to help him. I hired medical students and sociology grad students as interviewers, and in Rosetta we went house to house and talked to every person aged 21 and over, Brune remembers. This happened more than 50 years ago, but Brune still had a sense of amazement in his voice as he described what they found. There was no suicide, no alcoholism, no drug addiction, and very little crime. They didn't have anyone on welfare. Then we looked at peptic ulcers. They didn't have any of those either. These people were dying of old age. That's it. Wolf's profession had a name for a place like Rosetta, a place that lay outside everyday experience, where the normal rules did not apply. Rosetta was an outlier. Wolf's first thought was that the Rosettans must have held on to some dietary practices from the old world that left them healthier than other Americans. But he quickly realized that wasn't true. The Rosettans were cooking with lard instead of the much healthier olive oil they'd used back in Italy. Pizza in Italy was a thin crust with salt, oil, and perhaps some tomatoes, anchovies, or onions. Pizza in Pennsylvania was bread dough plus sausage, pepperoni, salami, ham, and sometimes eggs. Sweets like biscotti and tiralli used to be reserved for Christmas and Easter in Rosetta. Now they were eaten all year round. When Wolf had dietitians analyze the typical Rosettans' eating habits, he found that a whopping 41% of their calories came from fat. Nor was this a town where people got up at dawn to do yoga and run a brisk 6 miles. The Pennsylvanian Rosettans smoked heavily, and many were struggling with obesity. If it wasn't diet and exercise then, what about genetics? The Rosettans were a close-knit group from the same region of Italy, and Wolf's next thought was whether they were of a particularly hardy stock that protected them from disease. So he tracked down relatives of the Rosettans who were living in other parts of the United States to see if they shared the same remarkable good health as their cousins in Pennsylvania. They didn't. He then looked at the region where the Rosettans lived. Was it possible that there was something about living in the foothills of eastern Pennsylvania that was good for their health? The two closest towns to Rosetta were Bangor, which was just down the hill, and Nazareth, a few miles away. These were both about the same size as Rosetta and populated with the same kind of hard-working European immigrants. Wolf combed through both towns' medical records. For men over 65, the death rates from heart disease in Nazareth and Bangor were something like 3 times that of Rosetta. Another dead end. What Wolf began to realize was that the secret of Rosetta wasn't diet or exercise or genes or location. It had to be Rosetta itself. As Brune and Wolf walked around the town, they figured out why. They looked at how the Rosettans visited one another, stopping to chat in Italian on the street or cooking for each other in their backyards. They learned about the extended family clans that underlay the town's social structure. They saw how many homes had 3 generations living under one roof and how much respect grandparents commanded. They went to Mass at Our Lady of Mount Carmel and saw the unifying and calming effect of the church. They counted 22 separate civic organizations in a town of just under 2,000 people. They picked up on the particular egalitarian ethos of community that discouraged the wealthy from flaunting their success and helped the unsuccessful obscure their failures. In transplanting the Paisani culture of southern Italy to the hills of eastern Pennsylvania, the Rosettans had created a powerful protective social structure capable of insulating them from the pressures of the modern world. The Rosettans were healthy because of where they were from, because of the world they had created for themselves in their tiny little town in the hills. I remember going to Rosetta for the first time, and you'd see 3 generational family meals, all the bakeries, the people walking up and down the street, sitting on their porches talking to each other, the blouse mills where the women worked during the day while the men worked in the slate quarries, Brune said. It was magical. When Brune and Wolf first presented their findings to the medical community, you can imagine the kind of skepticism they faced. They went to conferences where their peers were presenting long rows of data arrayed in complex charts and referring to this kind of gene or that kind of physiological process, and they talked instead about the mysterious and magical benefits of people stopping to talk to one another on the street and having 3 generations living under one roof. Living a long life, the conventional wisdom said at the time, depended to a great extent on who we were, that is, our genes. It depended on the decisions people made, on what they chose to eat and how much they chose to exercise, and how effectively they were treated by the medical system. No one was used to thinking about health in terms of community. Wolf and Brun had to convince the medical establishment to think about health and heart attacks in an entirely new way. They had to get them to realize that you couldn't understand why someone was healthy if all you did was think about an individual's choices or actions in isolation. You had to look beyond the individual. You had to understand the culture they were a part of and who their friends and families were and what town their families came from. You had to appreciate the idea that the values of the world we inhabit and the people we surround ourselves with has a profound effect on who we are. In Outliers, I want to do for our understanding of success what Stuart Wolf did for our understanding of health.
Sadly, not long after the research mentioned just now was made public, life in Rosetto began to follow the trends of the rest of America. Beginning around the mid-1960s, all the strong traditions that kept Rosetans living longer began to fall apart. American life meant fences were erected between houses. People stopped going to church and having long family get-togethers afterwards. Kids left town to go to universities, and grandparents were put into rest homes. The three-generational homes became a thing of the past. As Malcolm Gladwell said just now, we are all a product of our environment. I wanted to share that with you today as a way of perhaps prompting you, asking you to look at the environment that is your veterinary clinic. And what can you do differently to create a sense of community? The introduction of the Western American lifestyle, not too different to what we're experiencing here in God's Own, meant long hours of work, social isolation, increased stress, and a processed food diet produced a quick jump in heart attacks and deaths due to atherosclerosis. Rosetto has now joined the melting pot of Western life and suffers all of its chronic diseases. So, back to compassion being good for you as well as being good for others. The next time you get to chat about the health of your client's fur baby, connect with them in a meaningful way as well. You don't need to get all of their life history like you need their pets, but I'm sure you can take 40 seconds to lean in and to look after yourself by connecting with another human being. I'm interested to hear what compassion and/or connection practices or strategies you have in place in your clinic that help your team stay head and heart healthy. I'm also pretty sure that other clinics would love to know what you do and what results you've had. Please send me an email or connect with me, julie@vetstaff.co.nz, so we can help other clinics benefit as well from your experiences. And talking of benefiting, if you enjoy this podcast, you can help others find it by leaving a comment, especially on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, because that's the algorithm that seems to have the most clout right now. Thank you. You can also subscribe direct from any of the main platforms, Apple Music, Spotify, iHeartRadio, so you never miss out on future episodes. Alternatively, you can go to the Paws, Claws, Wet Noses.fm website and subscribe there to be notified of all new episode releases. At the bottom of each episode, on its own episode page, is a sign-up form for you. Thank you for listening. Hi, this is Julie South, and you're listening to Paws, Claws, and Wet Noses, the Kiwi Veterinary Sector Podcast. If you're a Kiwi veterinary professional, then stay tuned because this show is for you. Each week's podcast is purpose-built to help you grow your veterinary business, yourself, or your life. You can find all the show notes and links mentioned in today's show at pawsclawswetnoses.fm. Thank you.